Lend me your ears, the Oral Dramaturgies podcast. The Gallery, interviews with artists.
Hello, and welcome to The Gallery. Like many artists of her generation, Australian performer and researcher Kate Hunter began her career in the 1980s in physical theatre. She trained extensively in the Tadashi Suzuki method of acting and with Anne Bogart's City Company in New York, and has created a number of acclaimed works of dance and physical theatre in collaboration with other Australian artists before moving on to sound-based performance and research in memory, performance and cognition. Her 2017 piece Earshot, made with performer Josephine Lang, sound designer Jem Savage, and dramaturg Glynis Angel, is described by the artists as part live performance, part undercover surveillance operation. In fact, Earshot is a truly inspired scenic rendition of a fully crowdsourced piece of text, generated through eavesdropping. Divorced from its original context, the resulting script is deconstructed and reassembled into a type of musical score and then performed to the accompaniment of kitchen implements, DIY voice filters, and ill-fitting transcript projections. I first encountered this piece by reading about it in an online review on witnessperformance.com and immediately felt I had to meet its maker. This conversation took place between Melbourne and London by Zoom on the 26th of May, 2020.
Thanks again, Kate, for making this time available and for making and sharing your work with us. I actually read about Earshot in Alison Krogan's review of your work in November last year. And I thought, my God, this sounds like exactly the kind of work that fits in within this remit.
Yeah, and it was a beautiful piece of writing. It felt like she really got it. She, you know, she really got the work. I mean, she's a writer and a dramaturg. Yes. She described Earshot as a theatrical poem, which I hadn't thought of it in those terms, but as soon as I read that, I realised that's what it is and was. She was very affected by it, and the work was critically acclaimed both in that season and the season that we did in 2017. So it's had two iterations, if you like. But it felt like she had a really enjoyable experience, and it kind of shifted the way she listened to things.
That was quite interesting, the way in which the piece attunes the ear to the poetry in the everyday speech. And what interests me about it is the way in which it departs from that model of verbatim theatre that we knew in the early 2000s, that everybody was making verbatim theatre, which was very often issue-based theatre, and rightly so. But this seems to have gone into a different territory, and in the way in which you actually perform it, it very often evokes musical performance, because you have scores on stands, you have the instruments that you have created for it. You actually also use other sorts of machinery to create sound in it.
Yes, we use all sorts of machinery, analog and digital. And it's interesting the way that came about. The music stands, I mean, I collaborate with musicians, so the other actor in the work, Josephine Lang, is a musician as well as a performer and composer, and the sound designer is a musician. I have played music quite a lot when I was younger and so much recently, but have an understanding of music. And I was kind of curious about the ways that I might investigate language through music and the idea of playing language through music. The music stands and the kind of the design of the work came about through a very pragmatic decision, which was when we had our first development of the work. I just said, I do not want to learn lines. I don't have time and I'm not interested in it. So let's just set some music stands up and have the scripts there, and we'll work from the scripts. It doesn't matter. It's a showing. You know, people understand that it's a development. But then what happened was there was this kind of formality around the setting up of a series of music stands, and we dressed quite formally. And we moved from one kind of station to the next, and we kind of started to explore or open up to this idea that maybe we might think of ourselves as musicians playing movements, you know, and that was a really helpful way of bringing the work together. And so, and the response from the audience was that form seemed to fit the content, and so we kept it. Each time we've worked the show, we've worked to that idea even more readily. So it's this idea of almost a recital of the Australian vernacular, if you like. Because, you know, there's a lot of fantastic vernacular implicit in Australian language, which is very particular to us. So that kind of came about accidentally. And a lot of my work is some accidents happen. And I'm a big believer in what Anne Bogart talks about, celebrating accidents. And so I'm always interested in stuff that isn't intended, that's mm-hmm. accidental, or that's on the edge or in the middle or left over.
Should we go back to actually when you mentioned you trained as a musician or you played music when you were younger? Can we go back to those early days? I'm interested in the formal training you've had, but also I'm interested in any other formative influences that existed in your cultural environment that might have determined your choices or your aesthetic.
The music wasn't a key contributor when I was younger. As a young aspiring actor, I did a lot of gymnastics all through school, and I was very interested in gymnastics and theatre. And I, after I left school, I really moved into sort of circus stuff and physical theatre. I worked with a theatre company called Born in a Taxi, which is a physical theatre company that explores ensemble physical improvisation. Mm-hmm. And they trained with Al Wunder, who's quite a seminal teacher here in Melbourne, has been here for many, many years. There was this kind of this curiosity around physical theatre and what was possible, you know, and I was kind of young and excitable and interested and curious and had some physical fitness and acumen.
When was this? Just to kind of align. Oh,
probably. Okay. So it probably would have been from about 80. Let's see. I'm 54, although I don't look it.
No, you don't look it.
Would have been around about, you know, 80, 85 to around about 95, say, mm-hmm, for around mm-hmm. 10 years mm-hmm. or so. I don't know. It's all a bit fuzzy. But I also started doing contact improvisation. Mm-hmm. So that kind of opened me up to a world of movement theatre and dance theatre. And then I discovered the Suzuki method of actor training. So a couple of City Company members came to Melbourne a few times, Barney O'Hanlon came more than once to Melbourne, and I started doing some work with him. And then I subsequently went to New York and attended the month-long City Company residency up in Saratoga, which was probably pretty seminal. That was early 2000s, I think. So that was a kind of a seminal experience because I met Anne Bogart, because it's such an incredible, you know, it's such a full-on immersive experience. I met some collaborators that I still work with today. You know, Viewpoints, I think, really spoke to the work that I was already doing with Born in a Taxi. So I had a familiarity with the vocabulary, but I loved that there was a vocabulary around the notions of space and time. And, you know, of course, I just love Suzuki training because it's a rigorous training. That also opens up the voice. But then what, you know, I think over time, you know, I got older and it's pretty rigorous on the body, that kind of training, particularly Suzuki training. And when I started my PhD, which was around about 2008, my research was around memory and the place of memory in the creative process. And I was also interested in the relationship between neuroscience and memory. You know, how the science of memory might be a metaphor for a theatre-making process. But in the process of that, I found myself, you know, I'd be in the studio and filming myself and just feeling like it wasn't helpful at all watching myself on video. And so I started to use an audio recorder to give myself instructions. That was the shift, really, to a whole new methodology, which was about talking to myself, listening to myself, and kind of engaging with myself as another actor in the room. And that work that you were talking about earlier, the 2011 work, Maybe We're Never Together, which was a work that I made with my beautiful friend Emily Collier, that came from a series of messages that we recorded for each other. We audio recorded messages for each other and then gave them to each other. And that generated a whole series of, you know, I'd record a message and then she'd record something back. They were sort of soliloquies to each other, really, but they became the content of the show. And that show was about our relationship with each other. And we made each other do things. And, you know, basically I was sort of mean to her and it was like a kind of interesting sort of meta unfolding of our relationship. But the key formal experiment with that show came from this process of audio recording, and, you know, which in a way is sort of self-verbatim.
Yeah.
Isn't it? I mean, I didn't realize it was.
Yeah. I'm interested in this moment, actually, if we can spend a bit more time on this moment where you decided to give yourself instructions in audio. But what was it in the process that initiated that methodology or that you discovered the unanticipated advantages of that way of working?
Well, I was working solo. I was wanting to be productive, and I found that it was difficult for me to generate material for myself just coming into a blank white studio. I'd lie on the ground a lot and listen to music and go, what am I doing? And I was reading about improvisation because that's improvisation is also a key component of my work. And I was working with solo physical improvisation. And I read an article by Kent Despain, who was a choreographer who described a process that he adopted where he asked his dancers to record themselves in the moment of dancing and then at the end of dancing. And he kind of gathered that material and coded it and used it as a way of, it was a research project really. So I was reading all this stuff about that, and that kind of, I think that was a moment where I thought I might try that. What happened then was I stopped looking at myself in video, so it became much more about what I was hearing. And so I could work with my eyes closed, but do the things that I was telling myself, for example. And so it was just a very fruitful pool. After a while, you know, the instructions stopped being instructions and they became things where I might have a conversation with myself. So I might pre-record some things and play that, and then I might speak live in the space in response to those. And then after a time, I started the words that I uttered in response, I recorded those words and they became a script that I then could break apart and then write into. And so it also became a way of generating texts as scripts. And so I started to build this group of written scripts as well as audio scripts that could then be crafted, edited, built on and re-recorded, crafted again, you know. So it became very complex and layered. It still is very complex and layered. That's just how it seems to manifest now.
And then when you took that further in working with your colleague on
We're Never Together.
I could be lying.
I mean, it's a very funny image, especially if you're not very little, like as like a 10-year-old.
Yeah.
Because tricycles are quite small.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think this was more like a bigger one.
Anyway, I never learned to ride a bike at all.
I know.
Which wasn't because my parents were fearful, it's because I'm a neglectful.
You can't ride a bike now.
No, I have ridden one once or twice for a few metres.
I would really love to see that. Yeah. I'd laugh a lot, I imagine.
In an emergency, I reckon I probably could. Quick, you must ride this bike! That was going to die anyway, so that's terrible. I'm not a good hero.
Could you describe how that worked? Was that just using phones, or was it actually something you were doing?
No, I had a Zoom recorder, so you know that was probably another thing that was a seminal moment, was when I purchased a Zoom recorder, and I've still got the same one that I've always used, although they're much more, you know, you can get much more groovy ones now, but I've just got a curmudgeonly one that's just. I still like to use. Sometimes she would use her phone and then send that to me, and then we'd transcribe it and then she'd re-record it. Sometimes we'd just sit together in a room and talk to each other and record that. And then those audio mashups became material that either we performed live or we had as pre-recorded audio that we did physical stuff to. And interestingly, a colleague of mine was helping me with that at the time with the audio stuff, and he said a really great thing, because I was saying, oh, these audios, you know, they're kind of clunky and they don't always fit together, and there's all this, you know, sometimes we're in the park and you can hear birds and it's going to be You know, I said, I want to make it all smooth. And he said, just don't over-engineer it. Just let the sounds speak for themselves. That was also useful because what then happened is I started to be interested in the accidental sounds that might happen. It's so interesting talking about it, just hearing myself talk about it and hearing about the progression of the methodology, because I'm realizing how one thing builds to another. So that idea of allowing the accidental sounds to be in the mix opened me up to all sorts of possibilities around incidentals. And so, you know, now I'm really interested in the ums and the ers and the you know, I'm sorries and the coughs and the, you know, and that all becomes much more, adds to the richness, particularly in earshot. I was really interested in that.
If I understand correctly, then the initial impulse was that in a way you were using this audio score the way a dancer might use a musical score to respond to, only you were not actually just performing as a dancer or making work as a dancer. You had more of a vocabulary of a theatre maker.
I mean, I think it probably began as a function, as a tool to assist me with generating material when I was trying to make a work on my own. You know, initially it was separate, but it ended up becoming the work itself. It ended up becoming a methodology, but it also became content because it became something that I started to incorporate in the work rather than just being something that was for generating other material. So from having an instruction to myself where I might press a button and then run into the middle of the room and the recording says, stand still for 10 seconds. Okay, now go, you know, now I don't know, run up and down until I say stop or whatever. So it initially would be physical instructions. Over time it became more complicated because I'd start to talk to myself in those instructions. Oh, maybe you shouldn't do that. Look, I'll tell you what, why don't you just stop for a second? Let me just, okay, I've thought about it. Let's do this thing. It's like the instructions became another partner. It was a subtle shift.
How did this content become a performance? I mean, how did you manipulate this content that you ended up with in rehearsal?
Well, that's a very big question. That speaks to, you know, how do we ever make decisions about anything really, about what to include and what to leave out? And I'm very interested in what I include and what I leave out. I always keep lists of what I don't include. And sometimes later on, the lists of things that I don't include become a whole other work that I do include. I'm not quite sure what drives the decisions about choices for material, except that, I mean, more recently those decisions are probably driven a little bit more specifically by themes that I'm exploring. I think in the earlier days when I was developing this methodology, I probably just thought, oh, that's quite funny when that sits next to that. Or that's a surprising juxtaposition. I'll keep that in. Or I've improvised an engaging kind of response to this provocation. I might keep that in. And certainly once you start to incorporate other actors in the work, then that's a whole other sort of aspect of possibility. So it's a combination, I think, of a really grounded improvisation practice that sits also with a composition practice. And those two things, I think, in my work sort of sit together in interesting ways.
I would kind of want to know a bit more about what the principles of the composition practice might be, but it may be just an intuitive thing you don't want to necessarily look into.
Well, I don't know if I have a set of absolutely set in stone principles. I mean, I'm interested in things like the way, you know, I can use space and architecture and juxtaposition. I mean, these days I enjoy using the notions of music as composition, so repetition or coda, the idea of coda, so coming back to something over time, or contrapuntal, you know, that idea of music that rhythmically sits slightly at odds with something else or underneath, so that you might have polyrhythms. I guess those are the sorts of things that interest me. I mean, I suppose I think compositionally probably a bit thematically and more conceptually than anything else.
And what were your musical influences?
I played a lot of piano when I was younger, and a lot of that was classical piano, but I love Sarti. I love Sarti's descriptors, and I've married a jazz musician, so, you know, I've listened to so much jazz in my life, but I also love Philip Glass and Steve Reich and Morton Feldman, and Arvo Pärt and those sort of minimalist, repetitive artists. I mean, I love Patti Smith too, but those sort of artists interest me, I think, just in terms of the way that they might work with repetition and building of musical images. I mean, I think the music thing is probably, it's a bit of an accident. I stumbled upon it. It wasn't a driving decision. It was the way that we've worked with the idea of music and performance in earshot. It was an accident that came out of that, you know, that development. And then as we started, in earshot, we work a lot with unison performance. Joe and I speak in unison a lot, and canon. So there's this kind of feeling that when we work together that we're playing with each other. We're playing music with each other, with our voices. And so we work together really well because we've done that for so long together. So there's a kind of a feeling. It's a little bit like we're playing music together. But I wouldn't say it's a purposeful decision. It feels like it's arisen over time through this sort of series of experiences that I've had.
Then just to put earshot in this continuity of like you starting working on your own with your own audio instructions, then having a piece where you work with audio instructions with someone else. And then, as you said, you kind of becoming more interested in the accidental unplanned as part of that process. So then earshot is kind of a piece which is all about the accidental in a way, isn't it?
It's completely about the accidental in a way, because earshot is constructed entirely of overheard and eavesdropped conversations that I've eavesdropped on and recorded, usually via a process of being somewhere in a public space, in the public domain, and with a computer and a laptop and typing. I have just had so many experiences when I've been standing in a supermarket queue or sitting on a train, and you hear someone on the phone and they're breaking up with their boyfriend, and they're completely sharing that information with everybody in the train carriage. Or, you know, they're talking about their most recent colostomy bag operation in great detail. And so I just kind of feel like I've always felt like there's such a lot of epic drama in these stories that we overhear, whether we want to overhear them or not. You know, I'd been traveling a lot. I was spending a lot of time in places like New York, and New York has an incredible oral sonic. Well, it probably doesn't at the moment, but usually it has an incredible sonic landscape. People talk and shout all the time really loudly everywhere. And so my ears were very enlivened to this wonderful array of voices and accents and stories. And one of my first trips to New York, I had my audio recorder with me and walked with it down the street. And I think that really just illuminated the potential to me of this idea around making a work out of material that the general public was generating for me. And then that's the reason also why I didn't really think about it as verbatim theatre, although it is. I didn't go into it thinking, oh, I'm going to make a verbatim piece and I'm going to subvert verbatim methodology. It wasn't about being interested even necessarily in people's agency. It's really about what I happened upon and this sort of beautiful poetic musical language that is our lives. How ethical it is, I don't know. I sometimes wonder if it's not at all ethical to just write down other people's stories and they don't know that I'm listening.
No, I'm not. You are. Yeah, who's an embarrassment? You. Yeah, me or you, who has not achieved one thing in 18 fucking years. So you have to blame everybody else. You didn't work when I was born. You haven't worked for your whole life. Oh, you didn't work when I was born. I don't care. You're talking crap. No, you want to be poor little fucking Leanne. You lied your fucking ass off when we were having an argument. High-pitched Minnie Mouse voice. Never thought I was abused. And then you fucking, I never said I was. Yes, you did. You said when I first went to Jackie, you said blah, blah, blah. No, I never did, nah. Then you lied your ass off. I never, you're a fucking liar. Never, ever, ever. Yes, you did. I swear on my muffled life. No, you're all fucking lying. You are. No, that is what you said. So, to prove your point, what's abuse anyway? Is this fucking abuse? I'm feeling abused now.
Did you have anyone see a show and say, that's me?
No, I did have a pretty tricky situation though, because in earshot, there is some material from someone who lives next door, but she's not sort of part of a theatre bubble, so she wasn't aware of it. The material gets so mediated, it gets so layered and re-voiced and re-performed and rewritten. In the process of making it, it's layered and crafted. So it doesn't really belong to the people that first uttered it, I don't think.
How long was the period of collecting these incidental sounds?
Oh, you know, years. I mean, I just am always collecting stuff. Some of it was from New York. Some of it was from when I was in Thailand and listened to four drunken Yorkshiremen at the bar. And probably, you know, 3 years of gathering material. Not everything made it in there, of course. And then how long did it take to make? Was that going to be your next question? Well, it's always interesting because in Australia it takes a really long time to make anything because, you know, I have to get money. And so it took a while to get the money. And so we sort of did it in stages. So probably I think from the time we had our first development in the beginning of 2016, the show went up at the end of 2017. So probably a couple of years. But it didn't take 2 years to develop. It took two years to manifest. And then we remounted it again for 2019.
In the process of making, you worked with another performer. You just mentioned that the way in which you worked with the material was a process of crafting and a process of transforming that initial material into a performance score. Can you describe that process of how you approached this material in rehearsal with your collaborator?
Well, Earshot is a collaboration with Josephine Lang, who's the other actor, and also Glynis Angel, who's the dramaturg, and Jim Savage, who's the sound designer. And I kind of think of the performance as a sort of a three-hander, really, between myself, Joe, and Jem, because Jem's sitting at the bio box, but he's live driving some of the audio in response to the way in which we're delivering the work. So it's a very, very collaborative process with all of the collaborators. And the work I'm doing now has those collaborators in it as well as a couple of additional ones. So it's building a kind of a really beautiful relationship. And, you know, in a way, we kind of write on the floor, I think, in some ways. What tends to happen is I gather a whole lot of, you know, ridiculous amounts of material in all sorts of different forms, like audio scripts and pre-recorded audios and written scripts and other stuff. And then I bring it all together and then I have to spend a bit of time explaining it and talking it through with the dramaturg, and she'll ask me pertinent questions, and she's really good at, she knows my work, so she's really good at trying to tease out the key driving artistic lines of inquiry, if you like. And then we sort of get it to some kind of point and then muck around with it on the floor for a while. And then I might go and write some more into it or rewrite something. You know, sometimes she'll say, this is working, but I think what happens if you wrote into it in this way? But then also when we're all together, you know, both Joe, the other actor, and Jem will, you know, Jem has a whole host of possibilities that he can offer. He offers brings a whole other set of offers as a sound designer. There's some instruments in that show that are built out of long hoses that we talk through, and they kind of analogically spatialize the sound so that we talk through them from the stage and they reach all the way out to the audience, and they're topped with big funnels and they come out near an audience member. So there's all sorts of kooky instruments made out of tin cans and camping pumps, you know, that play harmonics, and he'll reverb that, put some reverb on it. So it's an open, inquiry-based sort of collaborative process that is underpinned by my very particular aesthetic and curiosity about something.
May? Yeah, you need an interpreter.
I can speak English, though.
No, well, she says she needs an interpreter. Yes, but she doesn't actually need an interpreter because she says they don't interpret her words correctly. Yes, well, she needs one because she might not know the medical words in English.
I can speak English.
Yes, but you might not know the words. She needs an interpreter because she's written on the form that she needs an interpreter.
I can speak English.
No, you need an interpreter, so you've asked for one. So you have to have one. You have to have an interpreter now. There's no going back. It's on the form.
Claire, it's on the form. Fill in the name here, please. Next.
And what about the writing, the actual letters in the background of your performance?
Oh, yeah. I'm not sure if you're aware, but it's voice-activated text. So speaking into a microphone, we're mic'd up. Those texts are generated by something a little bit like Siri, you know, when you're talking mm-hmm. to you do a voice message on your phone, you dictate it, like dragon dictation. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So the software hears what we're saying, and it has to make this sort of syntactical sense, but of course it doesn't always hear correctly, so you get this really bizarre accidental poetry. And I was really interested in Earshot to see if I could add a different layer to the audience experience of language, of hearing and listening and reading and watching. So I was kind of interested in what might happen if they were listening to us speaking, but then they were seeing what we were saying, but it might not be exactly what they're hearing. And that's because I'm kind of curious about how we might intersect all of those things, reading, watching, listening, hearing, in performance. So it's really like a kind of language in lots of different levels, metaphorical as well as physical.
I'm just thinking about what you said at the beginning of the conversation about how, you know, you began your journey of theatre or as a theatre maker in a very physical way. To what extent is that sort of Suzuki training and that the fact that you have internalized that way of thinking about performance making is still there?
Well, I think Suzuki training grounds you in a presence and a state of readiness. That's incredibly important in any kind of performance. And even though we're not tearing around the stage in that piece, we do need to be very, very ready at all times, and we're also listening with all of our body. And we're also using our, you know, it's all about breath. So there's all sorts of things that are going on that perhaps the audience aren't privy to. We've got headphones as well. So sometimes we're performing headphone verbatim, so we're hearing an audio and we're speaking it at the same time. Sometimes we're reading it. And sometimes Joe and I are both hearing headphone verbatim and sort of improvising who speaks first. And so all of that delivery requires an incredibly refined sense of or capacity to listen and to sort of be focused, but also a very developed sense of the micro as well as the macro. And I think Suzuki training, certainly my experience of it, not just Suzuki training, but the other sort of improvisational, physical improvisation work that I've done has really grounded me in that. So I think it's really there, and that's where its beauty lies. I mean, a lot of people, I think, kind of gravitate towards training, that sort of training, because they feel like it's a, you know, they're all young and they're kind of feisty and they're sweaty and they want to just kind of do the thing, which is great, but I think there's a whole lot of other benefits that underpin it that are about attention and presence that really stand you in good stead over a longer career. I haven't had a sort of a traditional actor training history, so there's something about engaging with work physically and sort of task-based that I've always gravitated towards, because it means that I'm not so curious about demonstrating an idea. I just want to do the thing, mm-hmm. see what happens.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, shall we talk about the work you're doing at the moment? You mentioned you're developing a new piece in perpetuity, and this is with the same collaborators that you worked with on Earshot.
It's with the same collaborators as well as a choreographer and also a musician called Diana Weston, who is a harpsichordist. You know, I've got a lot of interest in disease and bodies and biology and medical processes and operations. And I've been very curious for some time now about the process of cryogenic freezing. That was sort of the leaping off point, really, for this work in perpetuity, which is kind of an examination of the notion of immortality and the different ways in which we are kind of curious about immortality and the extent to which we might go. In a way, this new work is building on the methodologies and the techniques of the previous work. So we're still working with microphones and, voicing written texts and using audio scripts and working with revoicing found texts like, I think we've got a couple of examples of work that we've taken from Good Morning Britain. Oh, and Ellen, like morning shows, and we're revoicing them. And because we're in this work, we're also working with pitch shifting software, so a bit like Laurie Anderson, uses or other. So we're able to, if there's just the two of us, we're able to provide the voices of six different characters in one scene using pitch shifting. So it's kind of a building on this idea of how you might work with the voice digitally. But also analogically, talking into a fan. I don't know if you've ever done that, but it's really fun. It makes you try it. It makes you sound like a Dalek. So to have the fan on and then talk into it. It's a fun thing to do when you haven't got anything else to do in an afternoon. So there's all this sort of fun stuff that you can do to change your voice with objects. And so I'm always interested in how we can do these things with objects as well as with the digital tools that we have. So that work is still in process. We've had a couple of really fruitful developments. It's got lots of physical stuff in there as well, so we're kind of working choreographically as well.
In Alison Krogan's review of Earshot, she actually characterizes you and your co-performer as voice artists, I think.
Great that she said that.
Do you identify with that? Are you happy with that?
I do now. It wasn't how I would have described myself. I mean, I have described myself as a theatre maker. So I thought that was a great description. And certainly I'm very interested in what the voice can do and the way the voice can be expanded, extended, extruded together and separately. And what I love about working with a microphone is that it gives you so much more capacity to explore. I mean, I don't particularly like my voice, but that's okay. That's just one of my anxieties. But I certainly enjoy working with a microphone, the potential of what a microphone can do in performance. When I first started using a Zoom recorder, you can put headphones on when you're using a Zoom, you can just walk around, and it also works as a microphone. So a microphone, when you're listening, just kind of explodes sound in your ears, but also when you're working vocally, there's all this stuff that you can do with sibilance and really low tones in performance that is very liberating and very interesting and very creative and very, really out there. You can make some really out there stuff. And I don't particularly like shows that where people are mic'd up just for the hell of it. It sort of annoys me. Mm-hmm. when you just go and see a theatre show and they've just got microphones all the time, and I just kind of go,
I know what you mean. Like
just project
Madonna.
Your voice.
Yes.
Yeah, the Madonna mics.
Yes.
And I don't think it's necessary, but I don't take my own advice because I really love working with a microphone, and I think it's a really creative tool.
Yes. Interesting. To what extent is like the way in which, for example, Anna Delia Smith, who is often seen as a progenitor of verbatim theatre, I mean, her specific technique is very much rooted in this skill of mimicry that she has as a performer, that she hears other people's voices and reproduces them in a way that actually feels faithful or whatever. Mm. To what extent is that mimicry an aspect of your interest as a performer?
Well, Anna Delia Smith, she learns the text as well. So she's performing a monologue that she's learned and she listens to. And I don't like doing that because I just don't like learning lines. So sometimes I'll work with what's called in Australia headphone verbatim. I think Nature Theatre of Oklahoma might have originated, but also there's a couple of people who work quite well-knownly in Australia in that realm, particularly Roslyn Odes. I just use it as a tool, again, to allow me to not have to learn lines. But there is something about being able to work from you know, having the voice in the ear and really work to reproduce the exact breathing pattern, the stops, the huffs, the exclamations, the inhalations. Again, it's a kind of a task-based exercise that takes you out of yourself in a way. But I don't always do that because sometimes the headphone, you know, what I'm listening to in my headphones is myself that is a recording of something that I've recorded over and over and over again. So it isn't necessarily someone else's voice. It's often my own or Joe's, because sometimes Joe and I perform each other's work, you know, each other's stories or each other's monologues, or I'll be performing her voice, even though it's my story. Yeah. So we share, you know, no one owns any of the stories or at all.
Yes. Right. Interesting.
That happened with Emily and myself, particularly when we did Maybe We're Never Together. Often we prepared all these stories, but then we often swapped them. So I'd be saying her words back to her. Again, it kind of explodes the traditional kind of relationship that we have with verbatim, which is about agency and about participants and testimony. Kind of lets go of that in a way. And it's more about the material itself, the words themselves being the fodder, if you like.
Right.
It's a material practice in a way, and that those recordings and those stories are materials that are manipulated.
Yes, right.
So it is an interesting way to think about it.
Thank you so much, Kate. That's been really interesting, really helpful.
Yeah. I hope it's of interest. I mean, it's great to just talk about it in that way, and it's great for you to ask those questions about the trajectory too of the practice, you know, because it's so rarely that we consider that. We're all just lurching from one thing to the next, aren't we? It just sounds like really cool research, and I'm very stoked to be some small part of it.
You've been listening to Lend Me Your Ears, presented by Duška Radosavljević, curated by Flora Petrolo, and produced by Tim Bano. The Lend Me Your Ears podcast is part of Oral Dramaturgies, an AHRC leadership fellowship held by Duška Radosavljević at the Royal Central School of Speech and Drama.